So I saw a quote this morning from a woman I know who's a retired minister, quoting Revelations that said the Antichrist will come, the Christians will believe he's the prophet and have his mark on their foreheads, and she had Make America Great hat on there. It's very scary.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today, Jim Kitchens, runs a longtime Democratic political polling firm called the Kitchens Group. He started back in the early 1980s and worked for House Majority Leader and Speaker Jim Wright, and more recently served as the message and polling consultant to Governor John Bel Edwards of Louisiana. I really enjoyed catching up with Jim and hearing what he thinks you need to do to win a big race in a red state, what he's doing entrepreneurial these days, and how he's feeling about politics. You should listen. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Jim Kitchens of the Kitchens Group.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Jim, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Yes, I'm Dr. James Kitchens. I have a PhD from the University of Florida with a specialty in political communication. I'm from Atlanta originally and got my bachelor's and master's at Georgia. I went to teach at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth in 1974. Within 2 years, I started consulting on the side, and certainly I was making much more money between 5 and midnight than I was 9 to 5. So we opened a firm. As the firm currently exists, was started in 83. We moved back to Orlando. My wife is a native of Orlando, as I say, a rare and endangered species these days. So we moved back to Orlando in 85, and the firm's been located here ever since. We have done polling and communication strategy virtually in every state in the union and in a couple of foreign countries.
First thing I noticed looking at your website was that your coworker had the same last name. So I assume that when you're saying we all along the way, the two of you started this together?
I started it. She joined the firm. We didn't get together for 3 years after she joined the firm. We both had kids from previous marriages. On Fridays, the kids used to come and we'd all go out for pizza. And the kids all got to be friends. And then suddenly we married our fortunes together and have been there for over 30 years.
Married your fortunes on every front.
On every front, between the kids, the politics, the whole deal.
How has that been working and living with the same person?
We have to be careful. And that's true. She especially was focused on doing focus groups and qualitative stuff. And I'm much more of a quantitative guy. When she joined the firm, I told her, I said, I can teach you enough statistics, but I can't teach you political instincts. And she was very active in the Democratic Party. So she had good political instincts. And we just had a rule that when we went home, you don't talk business. We talk kids, we talk something else, but we don't go home to discuss business. After, as I said, 33 years, it worked out pretty well.
Yeah. Well, congrats on that. That's actually a rare thing, I think, to pull off. You said you got going in Atlanta, grew up in Atlanta. Are you a Southerner? Do you think of yourself that way? Your practice seems to be leaning that way.
Yeah, I do think of myself as a Southerner, although we've worked all over the country, particularly in the early days when I was general rights pollster and he was, before he was speaker, he was majority leader in the House. And that meant he controlled all the campaign money. And I mean, I owe my career to him to a great extent. I helped him win in 1980 against Nick Pack. Then he took me to Washington, introduced me around, And when people would come to him and say, you know, Mr. Leader, I got a problem, he'd say, well, why don't you call Jim Kitchens and let him work it out? And if he said that, they'd do it. And so I built a practice in the house at a time when most house members, I didn't have to convince them I was the best pollster. I had to convince them to do a poll. Most polls were only done statewide, you know, for Senate and governor. Partly that's a technological problem, which got fixed when we could get computer files with census blocks on it and build a congressional district.
What was the route that had you meeting Jim Wright and becoming his pollster? How did that come about?
I was a professor at TCU, and I was, as I said, I started doing consulting work on the side, and I got called if I would go run a runoff race down in South Texas for Congressman Bill Patman. He wasn't a congressman, he was a state senator at the time. And I went down there, and Nick Pack, the National Conservative Political Action Committee, targeted him in a Democratic primary. And I noticed the ads they were running, and I read an article in the New York Times, and they were running the same ads with just different names all over the country. And it was the first time you really had that kind of third-party attack coming from an independent group. So we won that race. I went back to Fort Worth, not sure what I was going to do next. The friend of mine who was mayor of the city was my real first big win. His wife was on staff for Congressman Wright. And so they called Congressman Wright's financial people and said, I think you ought to talk to this guy because Congressman Wright's been targeted. At that point, Nick Pack targeted 14 congressional races and 6 U.S. Senate races. And in the House, the only two won were Jim Wright and Mo Udall, who then was from Arizona. I got a call from his big financial fundraising guy, local guy. He said, would you come over and meet with Congressman Wright on Friday afternoon? He's coming home Thursday night. And I said, sure. And so we went over and they said, explain to Congressman Wright what's going to happen. And I said, well, Congressman, they're going to say you voted to give away the Panama Canal, even though we know that that really was a Senate treaty. And they're going to say that you're for killing babies because you're pro-abortion. And Congressman Wright was one of my great heroes. He was a gentleman. His father was a Methodist minister. He was a very devout man. And he sat patiently and listened to me. And he said to me, young man, you may know some stuff I don't know about politics, but this is Fort Worth, Texas, and people don't behave that way. And so I said, okay. And I left Friday afternoon thinking, well, that's that. Sunday afternoon, about 2 o'clock, I get a call from this big money guy. He says, are you busy? And I said, no. And he says, could you come to my office? The congressman wants to see you. And I go to his office, and the congressman's sitting there with several of his major funders, and they hand me a yellow sheet of paper. And I open it up, and it's a trash can full of dead fetuses saying, Jim Wright killed these babies. I said, Congressman, where did you get this? He says, it was under my windshield when I came out of church, and I noticed it was on every other windshield in the parking lot. He said, maybe you know something I don't know. Maybe we ought to bring you into this campaign. So I did basically communication strategy in that campaign.
I remember in 1980, Nick Pack going after and being credited with knocking out like a whole host of liberal senators. It was that first Reagan run, and it was carnage. You know, the Frank Church, Birch Bayh, Culver, Eagleton. It was a mess.
Everybody. Yeah. Yeah.
It just absolutely changed the Senate.
It changed the Senate to that they had control. It also changed, I think, the face of politics because they saw how third-party attacks and attack messages work. And this, you don't say your opponent's name is a myth that doesn't matter. I mean, one of the TV ads they ran had this big, heavyset guy with a Texas Lone Star belt buckle and a 10-gallon hat leaning on a pickup truck. And he said, I used to vote for Jim Wright, but he voted to give away the Panama Canal. But it took me about 2 days to say, who the hell is this guy? I had somebody call the ad agency from another ad agency and say, we're interested in this guy as an actor for another spot. Can you send us his bio? Well, the guy lived in L.A. and he'd never been to Texas. And so we popped him hard on that as, you know, they're lying to you. This guy never voted for Jim Wright unless he was cheating. You know, so it was a matter of countering that third party attack that we had to do.
It feels to me like there's all too many Democratic campaigns that fail to fight back for some reason.
You are absolutely right. I'm working with a group here in Florida currently called the Florida Leadership Conference. And it's all former Democrats who've been in the legislature who are terribly upset with what's happening in the state. And they meet with the Democratic leadership. And they said, and one of our guys who was former Speaker of the House said, you know, with five people standing up, you can make you give a roll call vote on any bill. Right now, they're just doing voice votes and people can say, oh, I didn't vote for that. That was a voice vote, you know. So why don't you call for making them go on the record? And the rep looked at him and said, well, we got to work with these guys. We're going like, work with these guys. They're out there putting stakes through your heart. What are you talking about? But you're right. We'd rather almost be correct than win. And it bothers me terribly because we used to have some guys who would stand up and fight. And we got to fight back or we're in big trouble.
Sometimes when I talk to a pollster or political consultant who works in areas of the country where it's difficult for Democrats, I feel like they're maybe a little sharper tuned to how to make that fight because they're used to the combat of a real race. Do you see that?
Yeah. I have an old friend named Michael Mann, who was a campaign consultant from North Carolina, who we've worked with all over the country. And I won't be vulgar here, but he said the reason Southern boys make such good consultants is they'd rather fight than have sex. So we're used to going to the war and getting into it. And I do think that's true. I mean, if one of the races I'm most proud of was John Bel Edwards down in Louisiana when he was elected against David Vitter, who was a two-term U.S. senator. And everybody was afraid to talk about Vitter's problems of, you know, being in with a D.C. madam and all that stuff. You know, we just took him and put it right in his face. And because morals and the whole thing matters down there. Now, John Bell's a little bit different kind of Democrat, but I mean, Vitter started off ahead 54-27.
Yeah, actually, tell me about that race. First of all, how did you become the pollster for that race? I mean, I've read the story of it. I understand that what a long shot the future governor was. I understand that there was a complex primary that took something out of Vitter. Tell me the story from your perspective.
We started working for the House caucus. John Bel Edwards was the minority leader in the House. And we started working with him 8 years before the governor's race. And we started testing messages. Donald Trump stole our message because our message was Louisiana first, because Bobby Jindal was sending the pension funds to Wall Street to manage instead of Louisiana firms. Giving credit where credit is due, John Anderson, who's a direct mail consultant, came up with initially with that slogan. We tested it. It worked well. So we went on the attack in these House races, particularly in the rural areas. We knew we had to win those rural areas and hang on because that's where Democrats have problems. So we attacked the Republicans who were trying to get to the legislature. Even if they weren't in yet, they were going to put on that jersey. And so they're going to play for the team that wants to send the state pension money out of state. They're the people who want to close the charity hospital. So we attacked there. And at the same time, we were losing seats in Mississippi and New Jersey and Virginia. We were picking up seats in Louisiana. And John Bell, you know, the great late Raymond Strother, our media consultant, who I'm sure you know, Raymond, when I was a young consultant, said, look, you know, what we are do as political consultants is we got a horse around the track. But I can tell you, we're not going to win the Kentucky Derby on a jackass. You got to be sitting on a thoroughbred. And John Bel Edwards was a thoroughbred. He worked every day to raise money. He worked every day. I mean, he was relentless. So he was a great candidate. But we did our polling as we started into this race. We knew that Vitter would have to try to fight off some fairly notable Republicans. So it gave us a run to go. We also knew that we couldn't lose the gun issue or the abortion issue. John Bel was a Ranger, West Point Ranger. Jumped out of airplanes. I don't mean to criticize him. Carvel said one time he didn't care how many airplanes he jumped out of. He wasn't going to be governor. I knew that wasn't true because he didn't understand. We were taking the gun issue off. The abortion issue, his wife did a brilliant spot on about he was in his second tour. She got pregnant. The baby had spina bifida. The doctor advised an abortion. And he said, no, we're going to have this baby and raise this baby. And I'm resigning my commission. And he came home. And their daughter was getting married that year. She was a beautiful girl, 19 years old. And his wife ends this spot with a line that says, "That day, the boy I fell in love with in high school became the man I fell in love with for the rest of my life." I mean, and we could see every woman sitting on the couch in Louisiana punching their husband in the arm saying, "You're really not that good." So, I mean, we took those off the table, and then we went after Vitter and tied him somewhat to Jindal, even though they weren't allies. But the main thing we knew, I did the kind of what we call bio question, some information. What we came to realize is they didn't know about the whole Washington Madam and the hookers in Washington. So it had been long enough gone.
You mean the people of Louisiana?
People of Louisiana. Yeah. Motors yeah. didn't know. A very bright young aide of ours who had worked for the Education Association, who came in campaign, she went to look, Mary Patricia Ray, she went to look and see when he left the floor of the house what he missed. And she found out he missed a vote to honor 18 slave Marines when they got hit in Lebanon. So we ran a spot that said, and this is maybe the best line I've ever done in politics, even though a lot of people say, ooh, we ran a spot that said, when the country called, John Bel Edwards, and we showed him in his red cap, joined the Rangers to go fight for America. And we showed David Vitter in a trench coat, said, when David Vitter got a call, it was from a DC madam, and he went to meet his prostitute instead of voting to support the Marines. He chose prostitutes over patriots. And that was the tag.
What would you have done if you were on the other end of that, if you were Vitter's consultant and you got hit by that?
Geez, that's an interesting question. They did what they thought they could do, which was tie him to Obama, because Obama was unpopular. They needed to change that subject badly. I mean, one of the things that happened to him, though, they didn't know it was coming. And you've been in campaigns, I'm sure, where we do this strategically. This spot aired on the LSU-Alabama football game on Saturday night on ESPN. That's the first time it aired. And I got a text from a lobbyist that said, "Kill shot." I think the only thing they could have done, I might have pumped more money into turnout in those rural areas. I might have gone to try to suppress the vote among liberals. I would have gone and said, "John Bel Edwards is a pro-choicer. He does not support abortion rights." And see, he's firmly Catholic, and I respect his beliefs. But if I'm on the other side, I go say, tell every Democratic liberal I can find, this guy is not pro-choice. He is going to do away with your abortion rights and try to suppress the Democratic vote some.
Yeah. And they were doing some of that or not at all?
No, they didn't do that at all. They didn't think about that at all. They didn't think about suppressing our vote.
Do you think they thought they had it in the bag and let their guard down?
I think they thought they had it for a long time. When we got in the runoff, I think one of the keys was the African-American vote, no doubt about it. The African-American vote, 31% of the electorate were African-American. When Mary Landrieu lost, only 25% were African-American. That was a 6-point swing. And when we got to 40 and left Vitter at 29, John Bell's brother was treasurer of the campaign, and I told him this from a long-time experience back in 86 in Alabama, but I told him, I said, look, we hit 40 and they hit 29. I said, you better hire some people. He said, why? I said, because money's going to come to you so fast you can't count it and get it to the bank. Because then everybody believed he could win, so all the special interests started writing checks and sending them to him. And we raised a ton of money. We outraised him, and we raised a ton of money to communicate, and we raised a ton of money for our organization, and the African-American leaders saw that we had a chance to have a Democratic governor, and they went to the wall. So, I mean, it's one of those special moments that you rarely have. It really is.
How does that feel in retrospect right now? I mean, you've been in a lot of campaigns. You've been doing this since 83. Is that one just stand out, or?
I think that is as proud of a campaign as I've ever been involved in. You mentioned Long Shot, which was the book written about it by Tyler Bridges and Jeremy Alford. That night we won, and it was about midnight, and we went back to the ballroom, and it was empty, you know. And Kathleen Blanco, a former governor, and her husband, Coach, who had been always supporters, State Representative Sam Jones, who is one of the greatest Cajun politicians I've ever met, Jared Arsenault, who was the media consultant, his wife, and me and my wife sat there and had a beer and looked at each other and said, this is unbelievable. Because that was the group who had started 4 years earlier trying to plan this, and it all worked. It was a rare moment. It was a rare moment. You have some rare moments in campaigns. Some of them you know are going to win. Some of them you know you're going to lose. But when you can really do something you think changes the face of politics, that's important.
Some time ago, I guess it was a year ago, had Doug Jones on the podcast, who had won that race in Alabama. And another very strong candidate who won a state that we're just not winning these days. Does it take a sex scandal or the like to win a red state in 2024 time?
I don't know if it's a sex scandal, but one of the things which, going back 100 years to my doctoral program, I became convinced of is that voting is a choice behavior. If you're trying to figure out which car to buy, you have to look at price, color, what you can afford, what do you kind of you want style-wise. You know, and voting's not that different. Now, presidential campaigns, my one criticism of academia is they study presidential campaigns, which are very, very different. If you're in a campaign trying to get press coverage, it's very difficult. If you're a president, they cover you every day. There's not a day you don't see Donald Trump on the thing. I knew Doug because he worked with the Miller firm down in Mobile. I was friends with them for a long time. Doug was a absolutely very great candidate. But what they got the choice down to is that this guy they're running against is unacceptable. And you've got to have that to get them either not to vote or to switch over. But I mean, he is just not acceptable, ignoring the Supreme Court, you know, what he did. So here's your choice. You know, you have a very rational, very attractive, very bright guy versus this radical. Now, I know what you've got to ask me next is, why is Donald Trump dying so bad? Because it's become a revolution in this country, and I'm worried about it. I'm truly worried for the first time in my political life.
Yeah, now that you've opened the door on the Trump question, I guess I better walk through it. How do you understand this phenomenon? There's something different going on, both in the Republican Party and in him as an individual, that does feel different than politics has in my lifetime, for sure. How do you understand this?
Well, I think there's several factors, because I've been reading everything I can about this. First of all, too many media consultants for too long thought television and communication was about informing the voters. And television is entertainment media. Look at what we watch and what's the top things. I mean, he's kind of like this celebrity guy. I mean, he's an entertainer. So that's part of it. I think part of it's the election of Obama twice that terrorized the Southern white people. I think Obama tore the Band-Aid off how deep racism is in this country. And I think racism is huge, and I think it is a huge factor in voting. When you look at Georgia, for example, with Herschel Walker, and I know as we Democrats like to go, he's nuttier than fruitcake, but I'm a Georgia graduate, and I remember him winning a national championship. My brother, who still lives up in Georgia, told me that he was at the golf course, and they were talking about that race. And the guy said, I'm not voting for a black guy for U.S. Senate. It wasn't as nice to say black guy. I don't care what. And when you look at the results, every Republican on a statewide ballot, and I mean, there's things which nobody knows who's running. Commissioner of Education, Commissioner of Insurance, whatever, got over 2 million votes. Herschel Walker got 1.8. He had 250,000 people, white people, who would not vote for him, I'm convinced, because he was black. And that's the only reason.
When you say Obama tore the Band-Aid off and, you know, scared the heck out of Southern racists, basically, it puzzles me a bit because he struck me as such a non-scary man, you know, so calm, rational, kind, family man, you know, like, and half-half even. I mean, like, what was there to be terrorized by in Barack Obama?
It meant white people were losing power. That's where this whole conspiracy, oh, we want them across the border, get more brown people, more black people. It's this replacement theory crap. And it drives white people in the South crazy.
Maybe not just the South.
Well, no, that's true. That's true. I've a daughter who lives in Southern Illinois, and you go up there and there are Trump flags everywhere.
Yeah, that's the South too.
Yeah, that's the South too. That's right. That's the South too. But I think that they are afraid that our traditional, this white Christian nationalist, if you look at it, most of the people who describe themselves as that never go to church. They don't go to church. I was just reading an Atlantic article about that. You know, what it means is they're white nationalists. They want the white people to rule. They want the European rule. It's just unbelievable to me at this point in the 21st century. And I also think people are afraid of the Chinese and of the Muslims. And so we want a strong man. You remember that Russia went headed toward democracy, decided it was too messy, so they get him another strong man in.
But Russia has a history of strongmen, goes back to czars, and we have a history of, George Washington, et cetera.
Jefferson, yeah. Lincoln. Yeah. This is not our tradition, and I think that's why it shocks us, that there are enough people who think that maybe we ought to not have a democracy like we've had, who will vote for a guy, ignore their personal history. I mean, I got to say Trump was right. He could walk down Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody in the head and these people would still vote for him.
I guess I'm a little skeptical of how much theorizing is going on in the non-college white Christian nationalist groups. I suspect that there's a bunch of people who feel that way, but does that constitute a majority of that party, a majority of the country?
A majority of that party, yes. Yeah. But there are other things going on. I mean, we can talk about inflation going down, but prices are still high. Wages are still low. I mean, I live in Florida, which has the lowest average wage per hour than any state in the union. You have Disney, you have all these hotels who work people only 30 hours a week because if they work them 40, they have to pay benefits, right? So they work them 30 hours a week. So these people have to get two jobs making $8 an hour. We have all this, anti-immigration stuff and DeSantis spending our tax dollars to fly airplanes to Texas to move these people out. Yet we got state representatives down in South Florida telling the Hispanic community, don't worry if you're not in the country legally. This is just politics. You got to stay here and pick the crops. Because if they're not there to pick the crops, crops don't get picked. If you're going to get Americans to go pick strawberries in Polk County, Florida, you're going to have to pay them $20 an hour. They're currently paying $6. Are they paying 50 cents a pound? Now, it's basically a form of slave labor. And now we got Tyson Chicken getting sued because a 14-year-old gets killed in their plant. So they're just ignoring child labor laws. So they're trying to balance it and have it both ways. They want to hate these people, but they need them.
You wrote a book, which is really about public opinion, about understanding this sort of matter, Four Pillars. And I read an excerpt from it. I read a description of those pillars. And the first one, which was fear, if I remember correctly. I mean, they seemed like maybe four pillars of conservative thought, maybe more so than mine. But explain what they are and how you came about to that model.
Okay. Yes. The four pillars I took and tried to go back all the way to the beginning of the 20th century and tried to see what messages seemed to resonate with the American people and what moved them on their votes. And fear is one of them, but the great politician does not try to scare the electorate. The great politician relieves the fear. Fear is a natural emotion. I think voting is a great deal emotional. Fear is a natural emotion. You better be afraid of some things or you could get killed, right? You don't want to jump off a cliff. You die. And you go back to the greatest quote about fear is when FDR said, the only thing they have to fear is fear itself. And he relieved the fear. He went to try to say, don't be so afraid. We can do this. As opposed to a Dick Cheney, when they were running against Kerry, has a spot that says, if you elect Kerry, the terrorists will attack us. And they tried to scare the hell out of the electorate. Now, that was all of it. So fear can be used on both sides. The great politician relieves the fear. If you relieve the fear, that means they trust you and they will support you. Kennedy's great line of ask not what you can do for yourself, ask what you can do for your country. Come on, we can do this all together. Well, you don't have to be afraid. I think, you know, so fears, all of these can work on both sides. Okay. So it's whoever's got the best message going in. Right now, they're playing the fear on the southern border. That's their fear.
That's one of them. What are your other pillars?
The other one is religiosity. And I say that not religion. And it's divided out between the parties. On Republicans, it's religion, Christian, but religiosity, though, means the values you hold, that there's something greater than yourself. And it could be fairness. It can be compassion. It can be empathy. So those are the things which the Democrats try to argue. You can't hate these people because they're different. On the other side, they say, well, they're not like us. We ought to hate them. So there's where that divide goes. Narcissism is the next one. That goes everywhere. And this is a crying question I got into. When you see, like doing a poll in New Orleans, you say, what's the big issue? Oh, crime. Crime. It's crime's terrible. Then I ask them, do you feel very safe, somewhat safe, not safe, or not safe at all where you live? Most people say they feel safe. So what they're doing is kind of reflecting off what they see on the TV, because we know in local news, if it bleeds, it leads, right? People love where they live. I'm writing an article right now. I don't know how closely you followed the governor's race down in Louisiana. There were two guys that had a lot of money, both Republicans, Jeff Landry, who got elected, and the other one was Jeff Wagaspak, who worked for Louisiana Business and Industry Association. But Wagaspak opens his ad with this thing saying, our problem in this town, in this state is poverty. And he shows these horrible scenes of horrible poverty. Jeff Landry opens his saying, we live in a beautiful place, and shows the swamps and the beautiful landscape of Louisiana. Well, people don't want to think they live in a crap place. They love where they live. People in Louisiana particularly love where they live. They love the culture. They love where they live. So, you know, you got to understand. I always go into campaigns. I always kind of laugh when candidates say to me, says, oh, you got to understand, my people are different. I say, yeah, y'all don't have Target and you don't have Walmart, right? You don't have movie theaters. You don't have cable TV. Of course not. So, but everybody likes to think where they live is special, and even down to their neighborhood. So they tend to say, what's best for me? What's best for my family? That's the narcissism that runs. And there's a great divide on what people believe about what's best for their family. And the other one is economics. For years, the best predictor of voting behavior was economic self-interest. And I think it's kind of come back, particularly in this election. What is good for us economically? What is good for me? And we're sitting in a situation where labor has lost a lot of power over the last 40 years. And some people may disagree, but I just don't believe they're the clout they had in the 70s, at least. So how do you protect your economic interests? The Republican answer normally is cut taxes, get taxes low. The Democratic answer is, we have social programs that support and help move people upwardly mobile. And so that's where kind of the parties go. And it depends on the election as to which appeal will work best. And right now we're looking at the Republicans playing the fear card. Oh, we got to open borders. Well, we don't have open borders. We do have 3 million people in the immigration courts right now, I read this morning. But we don't open our borders for anybody to come in. I mean, that's just bull. But that's what people are afraid of. And that's what you hear Republicans tell you in focus groups. Oh, we got these open borders and it's scary. Economically, the inflation that we had has driven prices up. I mean, there's no doubt about that. You go look at the prices, and we haven't done anything to drive wages up. I have a friend who's a very good politician. He's in elected office now, I won't mention, but he says he thinks we're in the 1890s, where the robber barons run the government, the big industry guys run everything. I have a son who tells me, he says, Dad, I'll be 50 next year. We have been at war since the day I was born. Who benefits from the war? The industrial military complex that Ike talked about. So there's some real frustration with the government. There's real frustration with the way the economy's going. They had COVID in their family. And they said, you know, they can spend millions and billions of dollars for weapons overseas, but I can't get health care. Why is that? Which sounds like a Democratic argument, but he argues against everybody in Washington that it's the establishment. It's almost an anti-establishment argument.
If you were a consultant to President Biden, what would you tell him to do facing Trump, who is marshaling his argument, I guess, to put him back and playing a lot of strong cards and some pretty weak cards also? What would you advise him?
He has got to find a way to talk to voters who are under 30 years old. He's 80. I did Claude Pepper, you may remember, a congressman who served till he's 92. I did his last few campaigns. And it wasn't the fact he was old. It's never the fact you're old. It's how you act. Ronald Reagan didn't look his age. He dyed his hair and he shuffled around. It's how you act. Biden has not looked energetic and good. He has looked like he is 80 years old. And younger voters don't like that. And younger voters aren't sure that he really understands their problem. And I don't think they'll turn around and vote for Trump. I think it becomes a turnout deal. That unless you give them a really good reason, it may be based on fear of what Trump's going to do to them, to turn out, that's where you lose this race. And it's a presidential with the Electoral College. It's going to come down to 5 or 6 states. And it's very scary. I'm very worried. I know David Axelrod, they got mad at him because he said Biden ought to drop out, called him a prick. But I got to tell you something. I don't think David's wrong. These polls are concerning because if you have a thing that says, okay, the economy's the issue or foreign policy's the issue, you can do crap to shore that up and make that happen. What do you do when they say he's just too old? And I'm not sure what you do with that. That's a problem. Nikki Haley had the message. She kind of got off of it for a while. She was saying, understand, you're not voting for Biden. You're voting for Kamala Harris. Once again, a little racist spin there. But, you know, you have an African-American woman who's married to a guy who's Jewish. So do you want that, white American Christians? I mean, that's really what that says.
I guess for someone who found a way with John Bel Edwards to go after Vitter's weaknesses, Is there no hope of going after Trump's? There's so many things on that list. Or do you think he's Teflon because there's just too many problems?
I think he's Teflon because they got over it the first time. They just got over it and just said, I saw a quote this morning from a woman I know who's a retired minister quoting Revelations that said the Antichrist will come, the Christians will believe he's the prophet, and have his mark on their foreheads, and she had Make America Great hat on there. It's very scary. It is very scary. I had a state senator down in Louisiana this last, just not too long ago, probably 6 months ago, say he was at a rally. And this woman who's in her 70s, little lady in rural Louisiana, says, oh, I think Donald Trump's the second coming of Christ. And you're going like, really? Where are you getting this? It's a very frightening situation. If you read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, you don't have to read the whole thing. Read the first third of the book. This is where we are. I mean, unless somebody figures out, I mean, this guy is obviously an authoritarian. He is a dictator wannabe. I don't think there's any doubt. If he gets elected, support for Ukraine will be cut off. We may pull out of the United Nations. I mean, we may go back to pre-World War II kind of era stuff. And I think for those of us who are raised in the belief that democratic institutions matter, I think it's a real problem. I was telling somebody the other day, I had a wonderful high school history teacher, and the day after the Johnson-Goldwater election, he stood up in class and said, it doesn't matter who you were for, understand the American institutions are still strong, and we're going to all be okay. And I'm not sure I feel that way if Donald Trump gets elected president again.
What do you do differently as a political consultant in the age of Trump?
Well, I try to fight it from the ground up. One of the problems that we have is the Democrats don't have a bench. We lost too much. And we didn't focus enough down ballot. And so doing stuff like state House races, state Senate races, start building us a bench. There's a number of states where the congressional district is going to be rebuilt. We got to try to win some of those. I think where our focus has got to be is, you know, Biden has plenty of smart people on their team. They have plenty of money on their team. There's not a lot I can do for them, but I think we can help down ballot. We've got to start building a floor for us to get up. We had, I mentioned them one time before, this Democratic Leadership Conference. We had 20 some odd seats in Florida in the state House that were lost by less than 6 points. Now, you're talking about a lot of times by 100, 200 votes. And that's because we had a horrible turnout. We had a horrible gubernatorial race. But in a normal, semi-normal presidential year, we ought to pick up those seats. And we are focusing on the seats, and we're going to try to take those. All those guys who are in there voted for all this culture war crap. We have massive economic problems with our home insurance and with our auto insurance and with everything else. And they're out here yelling about don't say gay. And we're getting some support. We have a special election for the House today that should be very close, where we may take another seat for the state House. But we have got to start back and build us a bench. We got to have people who are capable of running against Rick Scott. Right now, we don't. I mean, he has millions of dollars he can put in it, but we don't have any rising star who can convince people they can win. So I think we got to build a bench. And I'm kind of old to start doing that, but that's what I'm doing.
Do you think that people who have become MAGA, let's call it, can be pulled out of that?
I'm not sure they can be pulled out of that, but they may be pulled out of voting. I don't know what happens if he gets convicted and actually goes to jail and to prison. I mean, that is fighting a lot of stuff. If we have some victories, or if Biden wins again, they may just go to the mountain and say, I'm not participating in democracy anymore, and go away. I don't think we convince them they're wrong. They think they're right. And I mean, it's what's unbelievable is what they think they're right about is these insane conspiracy theories.
When you're polling now, what is different? Trace a little bit the changes since 1983 in ability to assess public opinion.
Well, yeah, the first thing, we started very early doing internet polling. You got to talk to people where they are. Nobody has landlines anymore much, a few older people. So when we gather data, we have to gather it over the phone, the text messaging, the emails, and some of them are blind emails. We send them out and say, we want your opinion. And what we found very interesting on this as we get started is people, we say, we got to want your opinion about, you know, the upcoming election. If people opt in, they are very likely voters because we match it back to the voter file. That has changed. So we also do what's called weight raking, which says Gallup and Harris used to say, if your factors were right on, if your weight was right on two factors, then you probably had a pretty good sample. We weight on five factors at least. So we build a model. Because that's what polling is. You're building a model of what the election is supposed to look like. And I'm convinced that the last time when they missed so much on the Trump vote, they did not get enough uneducated white voters in the middle class. And they may have missed them because Republicans were telling their folks, don't answer polls, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But mathematically, you can do that. I have 23 hours of statistics at doctoral level, and I have started this new thing, which we tested in Louisiana and in North Carolina. I will go in and I can get 2,000 interviews statewide, and I can drill down to a House race and tell you where those people are and what they believe in and how they're going to vote. It's a very interesting system. I've been working with some academicians at Florida on it, but we did this in Louisiana. I can get one poll and then I got the data. I go down because people in similar demographics see the world as the same. I live in a place where two blocks down is my congressional line. Well, people who are registered like I am, who are educated like I am, who have the same income as I do, who are the same gender as I am, are more than likely to see the world as I do. We got into this because a big association wanted like 40 polls in districts because everything was battleground, even prize. And they're saying, but, you know, we can't afford $500,000 worth of polling. So this is the way we do it. It's a math game. So it's changed a lot. I mean, it used to be we would get 10 phone numbers for every response we need, and we had numbers left over. And polling was unusual, and people would talk to pollsters. It's become a more technical-oriented operation than I've ever seen.
What has been your attitude about polling as a business? Have you, like, thought of it as, this is a boutique firm, I don't really want to hire a lot of people, I don't want to do a lot of simultaneous... I mean, some kind of pollsters become shops for doing lots and lots of races, and some keep it very slim and try to have their own personal involvement. How have you thought about that? Has that changed over time, and how have you run your business?
Well, yeah. I mean, at one point, we had 7 employees, but I've always run my business. I had my friend Larry Powell, who was my office mate to my doctor. I hired him away from Mississippi State to come in because I knew he was one of the best statisticians I knew. And we had a bigger firm, and it was when it was easier to poll and had massive stuff. We always laugh about when we got our first fax machine and we were ahead of the curve technologically. But as I got older, I told somebody, I don't want to go sell. I want to go work in politics. I want to do campaigns. I want to have my hand on everything. And that's how it's changed. I mean, back in the old days, I was trying to make money and feed my family and do different things. I mean, we had 7, I guess, employees at one time. The problem is this is still a guru business. Candidates want people who understand politics and can help their campaign. And I always had a problem with the really large firms sending in second line analysts to help a campaign because I always felt like, do they really know what they're doing? And I didn't always think they did. You know, the way it was. When I started out on the Democratic side, there was Peter Hart and Bill Hamilton and Pat Caddell. And Tubby Harris was doing some stuff up in the Northeast. And the reason I was able to build this business is I went into the House because those guys were getting all the U.S. Senate and governor's races. And so I built my business in the U.S. Congress. And that allowed me to build a business. One of the things I always argued was we have no credentialing for this business. Anybody that wants to can hang out a shingle and say, I'm a political pollster or I'm a political media consultant. We have no credentialing in this business. And so anybody that trusts you will hire you. And I think we have had a number of people come and go in this business who really lack the academic background to understand polling and what it is and how to do it. And that's been a problem on both sides, Democrats and Republicans.
What do you think is different about you as a pollster than other folks that are used commonly?
I think 2 things. My specialty was in political communication. So I took a lot of social psychology, attitude change, measurement of attitudes, measurement of values classes. And so I think I know questionnaire wise, it's not about policy. It's about attitudes and values. That's 1. 2, my background in statistics, my first academic article was on the use of a new statistical process to analyze political data. I think my statistical numbers are much stronger than most people's. And I think that gives me a way to do things that people do, analysis people don't do.
Kind of surprised by that answer because I would think that for someone who's done as many campaigns over as many years as you, that the edge that you might have would be experience, you know, because there's got to be something that's learned by each incremental race, just like the patterns of politics. There's always this analog there.
You're right. I mean, the experience matters. For example, I mean, looking and seeing when Hillary Clinton behaved like an incumbent, and an incumbent on the polls gets what they get, and the challenger usually gets the rest, and they quit polling, and she wasn't over 50 in some of the Midwest states, and Trump beat her. That's a pattern I've seen over and over and over. Knowing where incumbents ought to be, knowing what communication can do. Yeah, experience certainly matters. But I don't like to discourage young people from getting involved in this, maybe getting their nose bloodied once or twice. I certainly did. And learning this. I'm working with a new company called Vantage Data House, where my partner's 28 years old. he did a year internship with me, and he wants to start his own company, and I'm helping him. And it's a very interesting deal.
What is Vantage Data House?
It's a nonpartisan thing. And what we figured out, and this is what we did in Louisiana. Vantage Data House, we figured out that everybody buys the same data, right? If you're a group, you're going to buy the same data. So why not produce the data and sell it to a bunch of people cheap? As long as they agree to share it, we got 20 lobbyists or so down in Louisiana, all chipped in. We did daily statewide tracking on all the statewide races. We did 16 legislative races down there. We did some tracking for them. They paid an upfront fee, but then we produced data for them.
So are you saying this is used by both sides now?
Yep.
Do some people find that concerning, or is it sort of?
Within the lobby community, they just want to know. They just want to know. That's why it's a nonpartisan thing. They just want to know who's going. And some of it's primary. A number of them, we had legislative primaries where only Democrats were in and only Republicans were in. Lobbyists want to know who's going to win there. So we produce data. It's a different business model. But if you're, say, the Hospital Association of Louisiana, and you got 40 races you're interested in, you can't go spend $600,000 to $700,000 to poll every one of those races. So it's a way for $25,000 to $30,000, you can get it all.
Yeah. Do you think that model could work in other states?
We're moving it to other states right now. We did it in Louisiana. We had what we call proof of methodology in there. So we did our projections down, and then there's a number of races we actually went in and did the polls and compared them to make sure they all lined up, and they do. Part of it is we're tribal. As I said, wherever you live, with your education, your registration, your values, people around you hold the same, or a number of people do.
Do you have ownership in that firm?
Yes. They gave me ownership in it just for my brain.
That's always good when that works out, huh?
Yeah, that worked out great. Yeah, they just said, if you'll be our operations officer and make sure we're technically all sound, we'll give you the stock, and here we'll roll the other out.
Yeah. Who's the founder, CEO?
His name is Bishop George. And I'll put you in touch with him. Bishop, he's a very interesting individual. I've known his father a long time. His father lives in Shreveport. His father's a doctor, but they made their money doing medical clinics with testing blood and stuff like that. And he has clinics all over Texas and Louisiana. And his father's been involved in politics down there for a long time. And so Bishop went to VMI, played football up there, quarterback up there, became a Navy SEAL, got his knee blown out somewhere with the SEALs. I didn't ask him where he was. Then earned his living for like 3 years as a professional poker player, Texas Hold'em player. He knows a lot about probability and stuff. So he called me and said, can I do an internship with you for free? And I said, sure, because I taught a course at University of Florida as an adjunct the last few years. I said, sure, I know your dad. I'd love to do it. And then he came back and said, I'm starting this business, and my brother and I will put the money up, and we'll give you a piece of the company if you'll help us. And I said, okay. So we started this, and he's got a lot of connections to Louisiana. That's when we started there. Now we're moving it out.
If you were running a campaign in Louisiana, would you use that data, or would you use that data plus do your own polling, or how would you think about it?
Well, I got to tell you, there's a number of statewide candidates who, it's so expensive to poll statewide every day and do tracking. We had a number of candidates buy into our system and use the data.
On both sides or on just on one side?
On both sides. On both sides.
Yeah.
Both sides.
And do you think that makes sense?
I think that makes sense. Yeah. Well, they're going to see the same. If they have a decent pollster, they're all going to see the same thing. You know, we don't tell them what to do with the data. I mean, that's different from being in a campaign like I was with John Bell advising, here's what you want to do. We just say, here's your data. Here's what it shows. If you have questions about demographics, tell us. We'll run you more tabs, whatever you want. You decide what you do with your data. So it becomes a data center, a big data center, as opposed to an advisory role. And I understand the advisory role because campaigns are paranoid. They don't want anybody to know what they know. But the truth is, everybody knows it.
There are these national polling data companies like the YouGovs of the world that provide either panels or samples, a lot of online stuff in some of the cases that you can buy data from. I'm not clear how much they come down to, how they're different or how they do at a local level. But they have big, big panels sometimes.
Right. They have big panels. But the other thing is that we call them members, not subscribers. Because our members can say, we want to know about this issue. We want about this issue statewide. We want about this issue in this state Senate district, and we'll provide it for them. Once we get our big database and we drill down, then we start several months out and we're pulling every day. We're doing regular tracking every day. And we could change questions in and out and move them in and out, you know.
Is the source of that data, how do you find your sample? Do you find it online? Is it a mix? Is it texting? Is it calling?
We use L2, which I think is the best list brokers around right now. We got everything matched with cell phone, landline, email, IP address, everything. We go in and pull a sample, just like I'd pull a sample if I'm working for a campaign.
They have a big voter, enhanced voter list that they sell to pollsters.
Yes. And they do every state, and they update it every 30 days. I've looked around. As far as I can tell, they're the best in there. So
does this give you a feeling of being entrepreneurial here at this point in your career?
Yeah, it really does. I don't know how many years I'm going to do this. At some point, I just need to go play golf, but it hasn't happened yet. I laugh because they were talking about Social Security. So, well, simple, raise the age. I'm going like, if I'm a bricklayer, I'm not laying brick at 70. I'm not doing carpentry work at 70, but I can probably sit on this computer and do mine work at 70, right? Yeah. So, yeah. But it does. It keeps you going. My wife just published a book, and we had a big book signing and all this a few days ago. We just have worked all our lives. Until my brain goes, I'm going to do something. I'm going to do something.
You know, it's Jerry Tyson, who pointed you to me, and he's also in a somewhat similar age cohort. When you think about consultants that have been around since the early 80s, that are still going, who else comes to mind that is good?
God, Jerry is about the only one I know that's been going as long as we have. Let me think about it here. There's a guy named Stan Atkins in Miami who does a lot of South Florida work, who we have done a lot of work with, who's a media consultant. He's very good and still growing. We lost Raymond. There's not many guys who are our age who keep doing this. We're kind of like the old horses in the fire station. When the bell rings, we kind of rear up and say, let's go. For a long time, I stayed in touch with Joe Slade White, who we just passed about a year ago.
Yeah, I interviewed him a couple times before he died. It was very sad to see him pass. Yeah.
Joe Slade was one of the most brilliant media guys I knew. He really was. He was incredibly creative. I still am on Facebook with Les Francis and Dane's still around. Dane Strother's still around. Bill Fletcher's still around in Nashville, and John Rowley. John's not as old as us. He was the young partner in that firm. He's not short in the tooth. He may not be long in the tooth yet, but he's not short. You know. So
these are mostly people who work in the South that you're mentioning, I think.
People I've worked with everywhere.
How about among the youngest generation? Notice anybody?
There's a guy named, if I can get him out of Louisiana, there's a guy named Jared Arsenault who did John Bel Edwards' campaign, who came out of a firm down there. I can't remember his mentor's name. But Jared went to film school and is very, very good. There is a general consultant down there, also in Baton Rouge, named Mary Patricia Ray, who is very, Ray, W-R-A-Y, who is very good at what she does. Florida's a hard one because I don't know who is doing stuff. In terms of other pollsters, I think Anzalone's numbers are good. I think he's pretty good.
He seems like a sensible guy.
Yeah, he's a good bit younger than me. And I think he's done a really good job business-wise building his firm from Montgomery, Alabama. He has done a good job. John Anderson, Mad Dog Mail. John's a good bit younger than me. He's done a lot of work on caucuses. He was executive director of the Georgia Democratic Party for a while. Really bright guy. Really bright guy.
Jim, what should I have asked you that I failed to?
Ooh, that's interesting. Maybe two things. What is the most important lesson I've learned in politics? and how our presidential is different from everything else.
Well, let's take the first of those. What is the most important lesson you've learned in politics?
Conventional wisdom is often wrong.
Oh, boy. How would you know when it is?
Well, that's what I try to figure out. Everybody said that John Vitter couldn't be beat. That was conventional wisdom down there. When people say for certain things are for sure, then you can count on the fact they're not for sure. You better take a look.
Yeah, you know, sometime Harry Truman might win in 1948.
Yeah, he might. People didn't believe it, though. This is a fairly small community of people who follow politics all the time, you know? And we get into talking to ourselves and convince ourselves what one person says is right, and we pass it on, it becomes a circle. And we don't ever stop to look and say, well, what if? What if this doesn't happen? What if that doesn't happen?
Do you happen to follow Simon Rosenberg and his writing on politics?
No.
He used to run the New Democrat Network. So he was going against the grain in the midterms when everybody was saying, you know, the pattern is that
it'll be a landslide.
Yeah. And he was saying, no, it's not going to be this, and this is why. And right now he is taking an optimistic swing at the 2024 election for Democrats. He says that a party is actually stronger than people think, that it's been winning the races in between the last midterm and now, that Biden has been a good president and done a lot of good things for the country, that they are poised to nominate a really, really flawed candidate on the other side, like just kind of basic things like that. And I'll tell you, it's pleasant to read his stuff.
I wouldn't think that's wrong. I mean, we look at what's happened in Kansas and in Kentucky and other places, like on the abortion issue.
Ohio, yeah.
We did some polling in Kansas on the abortion issue, and I told them, this is not going to pass. And they didn't understand. Well, it's conservative. I'm saying, yeah, but look at Johnson County, Kansas. It's a suburb of Kansas City. It's well-educated. They love their public schools. There's upper-middle-class women. You think they're going to give the legislature control of the abortion issue? No, they're not going to do that. And I polled them, and I said, they're going to get killed. And they did. We went back in and looked, and that's where it happened. There is some reason to do that. When any party goes a bridge too far, it tends to cost them. And I think Trump may go a bridge too far. I mean, because his campaign's about revenge. Yeah. Well, he wants to hurt people.
You could see that he's trying to back off that a little bit even lately, which is a shocker for him to back off anything.
I think Roger Stone and Manafort I don't think they're public. I don't think they're doing it. But this campaign has all the earmarks of Roger Stone. I've known Roger Stone for years and watched his campaign. I think this campaign has all the earmarks of a Roger Stone effort.
Explain.
He knows when to attack hard and then when to back off. And I see Trump doing that. I see Trump didn't go out and lamb blast the other Republicans who finished down ballot and way behind. He just kind of shrugged it and said, well, you know, guys, there we go. Because he didn't want to isolate all their supporters away from him.
It feels like somebody has his ear. Lately.
Yes.
I don't know who it is. There are some operatives near him now that maybe have some influence.
That are influencing the way he behaves and when he goes hot and when he goes cool. And somebody has his ear. You're exactly right. And, you know.
Do you think Donald Trump is a skillful politician?
I think he's a skillful con man. I think he's a skillful con man. I mean, you look what he's done in business. They're getting him in New York, the way to leverage money, the way to build stuff, the way to convince people, oh, yeah, I got Trump stakes, Trump University, Trump shirts. You know, none of that was successful, but he got investors to give him a lot of money for it. So, yeah, he's the P.T. Barnum of our generation. I mean, he does that sale. We just seem to be in a different age. It's an age where the rules of politics that you and I have known for 30 or 40 years just doesn't seem to apply.
I'm waiting for someone to say the emperor has no clothes.
Right. And I'm afraid his supporters will say, yeah, we like him naked.
We see the clothes.
Yeah, he's got great clothes, man. What are you talking about? He's got Trump shirts on. Well, let's go. But we thought that, you know, when he got elected. And I think this victim card, he knows when to play that victim card. And he does it very well.
All the time. Yep. Well, Jim, it's been great to talk to you. It's fun to get to know you a little bit. Anything else you want to say?
No, I just thank you for doing this. This is a great thing to do, to have on an iPod on politics, and we're guys running around, even old guys like me who can talk. I appreciate it. I'd love to come back on. Let's go see what happens, and maybe we'll have something else to discuss.
Okay. Well, have a great rest of the day.
You too.
That was Jim Kitchens. He's at thekitchensgroupresearch.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.